everybody, and welcome to the Fortress of Comic News, episode 256. I am your solo host this week, Chris. Got a really cool episode for you. So our good buddy Russell Nolte has his anthology series up on Kickstarter called Cthulhu is Hard to Spell. This is volume 3 of that series. And we did a little panel discussion about the whole anthology. So this is separated into two parts. Obviously all in one episode this week. The first part is going to be Russell Nolte himself, Tara Clarkson, and current former guest of the show, Timothy Flynn. We talk about their stories. We talk a little bit about the behind the scenes of the submission process and a bunch of other stuff. And then part two, which will immediately follow part one, we have once again Russell Nolte, Jessica Mason, and JD Olivia. And in that one, we do the same. We talk about their stories in it. We get a little bit behind the scenes on their submission. And then we talk about the Kickstarter itself. I had a great time doing it. It was the first time we'd done anything like that. And I thought it came out really well. I hope you all enjoy it. So as I say multiple times in the interview, remember that in the show notes down below is the link to the Kickstarter as well as Russell's website. So you can check out his work and the project going on right now. It is still on Kickstarter, still trying to get funded. And looks like just a really, really cool book. And before I send you off to that, so I remind everybody to follow me at Fortress Chris on Twitter, at Fortress Comics _ on Twitter. FortressComicNews.com for the website, Patreon.com/FortressComics. Give us the 5 stars, like, subscribe, share, comment down below, all that fun stuff. Mike will be back next week with another amazing guest. But for this episode, enjoy the Cthulhu is Hard to Spell Volume 3 panel discussion. All right, everybody. This is part one of our Cthulhu is Hard to Spell Volume 3 anthology series. I have 3 guests with me right now. Right, you'll see, if you're watching the video, you see all the little squares and everything. If you're on the audio, I don't know what to do for you. But we've got Russell Nolte with us. We've got Timothy Fling and Tara Clarkson. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And you all probably remember Timothy was on, were you on last month?
Yeah, it was about, I guess it was a month ago now that you mention it, because it was the previous book.
Yes, so...
Back then I was sort of telling you about the one that was coming out, and now we're sort of ankle deep in it.
So Timothy apparently wanted to come back. We were good to him, so...
Yeah, I had a good time, actually.
So Russ, let's start with you. I guess explain the book to everybody out there.
Sure, so Cthulhu is Hard to Spell is an anthology series dealing with the gods and monsters of H.P. Lovecraft, so... it came out originally, the first volume, in 2018. And the big hook, the big differentiating factor is Lovecraft's work really doesn't deal a lot with the gods and mythos itself. And we, so this the whole series is kind of a celebration of the mythos part of Lovecraft. When crafting an anthology series about H.P. Lovecraft, like, there's a lot of competition. Like, there's a lot of not only Lovecraft's own work, which is basically anthology-like short stories, very heavily, because he serialized a lot of his work. But it is, then people came on, and, you know, there's basically 100 years in a relatively unbroken chain of, like, Lovecraft anthologies that have come out either from H.P. Lovecraft collections or from people who were inspired by Lovecraft collections. But there's not... I mean, there's stuff that deals with the mythos, because you can't have 100 years of your work without dealing and delving into the actual mythos side and the gods themselves. But comparatively, there's very little that kind of collects stories about the gods and monsters themselves. And Lovecraft's original work doesn't do that either. Like, it's not, his stuff is very horror focused. And he basically invented cosmic horror, but the work, the monsters themselves, because they're unknowable and unthinkable and unfathomable, like, kind of play an off-camera role in for 90% of the story. And if they even appear, they appear at the very, very, very end of the story and wreck stuff and then leave everyone worse off for wear. And then the story ends. So this collection was really like, what if instead of doing that, we focused the light on the Lovecraft gods and monsters themselves. And in doing so, we could tell different kinds of stories. So there are some definitely Lovecraftian stories in the tradition of Lovecraft, meaning like weird person goes to weird town, makes weird deal, finds weird cult, like unlocks unfathomable monster. And in that kind of vein, or like cosmic horror vein, but there's also cute stories and silly stories and slice of life stories and fantasy stories and science fiction stories and dramatic stories, kind of all over the spectrum as far as what comic creators do. And the one rule is that the story has to focus or have a focus on one of the gods or monsters from the universe itself.
So in each volume of this anthology, do you also do a story in it?
I do.
What is your story this time?
This story. So one of the biggest complaint that we've had about the series is that the covers of the books, which everyone loves, don't correlate to any of the stories inside of the book. So I wanted to change that this time. And for the final one, I really wanted to use Royal Rumble, but like, I was not going to get away with using Royal Rumble. Like, that was I chose Battle Royale, and the big cover is Cthulhu jumping off the pylon onto Zeus. And so the story inside that Eric and I did is the three parts, 12 pages, 4, 4, 4 in the beginning, middle, and end of the Lovecraftian gods versus the mythological gods with the fate of the universe hanging in the balance.
Awesome. So I guess we'll go around the table. Timothy, what was your story in this anthology?
Oh, okay. Well, my short story, and first, thanks for having me, guys. That's always just a real thrill to do these things, and I'm just really want to say thanks. The first short story we did for the anthology, it was called The Error of the Last Acolyte, and I'm under direct instructions to not spoil the storyline, so I will just tell you. It is a 1970s sci-fi take on a Lovecraftian tale, in this case taking the form of some mysterious monks and an unspeakable monstrous. So other than that, I would encourage you to read the story. And this was penciled by my friend and partner, Renan Shodi. And we've kept working together, by the way, after the story we did. And I just wanted to give him a shout out because he's just been a terrific creative partner for me and really happy with the way that things turned out. And I hope people enjoy this story. There's one more element that's roughly connected. I don't know, maybe I'll let Russell mention that, but some people know there's a song that goes with it too. So I was involved in the making of that, and it was just really a terrific experience the whole way around. Honestly, we had so much fun, me and the gang that did our contribution. So, but I hope you love the story. I would say that if you love Lovecraft, you'll see his elements in our short story. And if you also are a little bit like, well, like also kind of like weird sci-fi, you also will probably like our story.
So when you say 70s sci-fi, you know, my brain, because there's only one sci-fi in my world, not Star Wars. Are we got Star Wars vibes?
Maybe not necessarily Star Wars, but well, you know, I'll tell you, I approach the term Star Wars pretty broadly. I should mention very quickly, I'm not like a hater. Like, I generally like almost all Star Wars things, right? So, and some of that, I guess, is the way I grew up. So, you know, our other series definitely has some pretty strong Star Wars elements. What I mean by that is that it's not a very hard sci-fi. The emphasis is on the fantastic elements of a sci-fi world. But in the case of the our short story for the Cthulhu anthology, it's a little bit darker. I would just say that, and it would be more along the lines of like your Silent Running, Logan's Run, those the Charlton Heston era of 70s sci-fi dialogue. And I think even when you hear the dialogue, it'll even ring to you a little bit, because that was I got a terrific kick out of writing dialogue. I always like weird creatures and the way they communicate with each other. And in this case, the assignment of these weird monks, I had fun making it. So I really hope you guys dig it, man. I'd really like to see the sequel.
That sounds cool. And last but certainly not least, Tara, how about your story?
Mine is a story called Delivery that my writing partner, Kang Jing, who does the artwork for it, and I put together. And it's funny to mention Star Wars, because it's basically, for me, it was my reflection on kind of like what Star Wars means to me, and what resistance looks like on a ground level and how you keep it going. And so I picked the most random of all Lovecraft monsters. It was like the Spiders of Ling. And it starts with the main character fleeing this spider, and it just kind of goes on from there. But it's pretty fun. It's a little four pager.
So I guess any of you could answer this really. For someone kind of like myself, I would say moderate to low knowledge of Lovecraft stuff. Do you think that someone like me could get into this anthology?
I think it was made for people like you. Like, we made it so the original instinct was, I asked all of my fans who had supported all of our work before, like, what do you want? And they all said a Lovecraft anthology. I was like, okay, like, that's very broad. Like, why? And like, what specifically? And the general consensus was, what they wanted was, as a fan of Lovecraft, it has a very high barrier to entry. Like Lovecraft has a very high bar, especially to understand the lore. They wanted something that they could kind of like bring people and indoctrinate into the mythos. And so that was one of the reasons we chose to focus on the gods and monsters themselves, was because like, that's the easiest way into the lore. Like, that's the thing that Lovecraft, like, His explanations of gods would be like, an unfathomable being stood before me, or like an unknowable light, or when they did the color of it's not the color of light, the color out of space. Like, the big thing for Nick that they did when they remade that was like, Lovecraft kind of just says like an unknowable or an unknowable like color, and you're like, okay, well, that's great. Like, how do I make an unknowable color knowable? And that's why the film is magenta, because magenta doesn't actually exist as a color. So it's like, that was the easiest one to be like, oh, like, clearly if you have an unknowable color, an unnatural color, it would be, that would be what would be there, because like, it doesn't actually exist. So we did the origin myth, we did some retellings, and we just did a lot of like of lore building that all has its basis in Lovecraft's works. So for instance, there was a story which was Orn and Numqua, who are like the Ross and Rachel of the Lovecraft universe, as much as anyone can be. And like, they're in marriage counseling. So it's like that would never happen in Lovecraft's world. But if you come across Orn and Numqua, like, you will understand kind of that they have this dysfunctional marriage relationship. There's a story in this one where Shub-Niggurath, the black goat of the woods, like, has a lot of kids. It's just like, that's her thing, like, birthing thousands of like Lovecraftian horrors. And there's a story of like an adventurer coming along around her, and like, she like pulls out a wallet and is like showing all of the kids off. So again, like, that doesn't that would never happen in Lovecraft's world, but if you come across that, we hope that you would be like, oh, I get like which one they're talking about. It's the one with the million kids. And we really made it. It's wonderful, because because no one really focuses on this outside of, I think it's Chaosium, the people that make the Call of Cthulhu game, like very few books have ever dealt with Lovecraft's, like the lore of it specifically. It's something that real hardcore Lovecraft fans like really get into because like it helps like their own knowledge of the world. But what it's really for is that someone who loves Lovecraft can be like, you know that thing I've been trying to get you into for like a decade? Here, like try this and then maybe you'll understand the world. Because he really did not. He was not easy. Well, he was not easy just as a period human, but he was not easy on readers. He would name a god like in one paragraph in one story. And like you just had to know that was the one story. You had to read the whole thing to get any idea. And if you missed that one paragraph, like you just didn't know that God existed.
Yeah. So I'll go down my knowledge of Lovecraft. The episode of South Park. I watched Lovecraft County. That was a good show. And I know he has a cat that we can't say on the internet because it's very offensive. And that's about it for my Lovecraft knowledge.
Were any of us fans of Alan Moore's Neonomicon, or did anybody read that one?
I didn't personally, but I knew a lot of people who did. And I know Alan was a big Lovecraft guy as well. Because right? Is Necronomicon a Lovecraft thing?
Yeah. Well, this was kind of Alan Moore's twist on it, I guess you would say. And it's pretty well done. And I sometimes steer people toward it if they are, well, it's like Russell said, that it's not the most accessible read. So sometimes if you're trying to explain the mythos, you might benefit from showing them Neonomicon. It's something that they can, it's very visual for one thing.
Yeah.
It's a little bit, and by the way, I feel that it's like a really loving tribute to him as well. I think that he really kind of nails it. That's why I mention it.
So there's always, in my eyes, I mean, there's many different kinds of anthologies, but there's really, I separate them into kind of two categories. And I would like to know what kind this is. We have a single theme or idea, in this case, Cthulhu, and just all the stories are random. And then the other one is where things are kind of interconnected in some way. Are any of these stories interconnected at all, or are they all just kind of what they are?
So the anthology has a theme, as a theme of Lovecraft, but each story has each volume has like an idea behind it, which is the first book, the gods are planning to their invasion. The second book, the gods have invaded and taken over, or in the process of invading and taking over. And in this one, the third one, it's mythological gods and humanity and like things are coming along to try and push back this invasion. And so in that way, I hope they're interconnected. But in the like, do these things cross over with each other? Like they don't cross over in that way. They just kind of live in this kind of world. And I hope that you can soak it up. But I don't know, Tara, what do you think?
I think the theme is really strong, and yeah, I didn't notice individual stories really interacting with each other as like this is part of a shared universe in a really knowing kind of way, but the theme is really strong, I think, even between all the like wildly different ones. Like you said, some are just really, really funny. Some are really scary, still like all ages, but yeah, I think the theme is really well tied together and the stories are just very separate.
So at no point are you trying to hit story beats to get to a certain point?
No, I don't think
okay.
So. That's why I did the three different segments of my story, the 12 pages that broke up. Cause like, there's at least like thematically, like there's like the beginning of the book is kind of like their plan, the attack is happening, the all chaos is kind of going on in the middle, and then like there's like a kind of resolution in the end.
That's a really cathartic framing. That's awesome.
So for the anthology itself, then and I guess anyone could really answer this. How did, actually, anyone but Russ, I want to answer this. Sorry, Russ. I know he does a submission process for this. How was that submission process for you two? And what was it like from your point of view? I guess we can start with Tara.
Tara, go first.
Sure, yeah. It was pretty neat for me. I have not... this was one of my first pitches to ever submit anywhere. And it was like... It was a mountain. It was like... would have been a dream come true to get into it, because just everything that I love in stories seemed to be in this anthology. And the caliber of talent in the previous... It was just... Yeah. I'm still kind of reeling all these months later. But I had put forward a pitch for a story that was too long. And I got word back. It's like, okay, well, I like the idea. It's too long. Can you make it shorter? And I did. And it didn't quite make it. It almost made it. But then something opened up. There was a little more room and it got in. And that was a huge day. But it was neat. It was a really neat experience. Yeah.
Timothy?
You know, in my case, we were intentionally trying to write stories to be submitted for anthologies. And I knew about Russell's anthology, and really from scratch, I had the target painted on that one. And I sort of got lucky even too to get partnered up with the artist I did. And, you know, sometimes lightning kind of strikes you. And I think that happened here. And you know, I've been very fortunate throughout the process. I was pretty stoked, I'll tell you that. This was my first big submission to a major publisher, right? So I was going to bring my A game. So we pretty much had all the elements plotted out and even the test pages done before the submissions even closed. The goal was to have the darn thing wrapped up and kind of try to be the first one. I don't think I was quite first. But, you know, it was an intentional, hey, we're going to try and get in this anthology. Actually, there was this one, there was two. The other one is the Planet Comics arrangement. I got a little arrangement going with them where some of the short stories are anthologized into Planet Comics. So but by some weird quirk, Planet came out first. But technically, Cthulhu Is Hard to Spell is my first anthology that I was published to. So thanks so much for the opportunity. You know, I really learned a lot from it. And I told Russell this in the last podcast, that the book hasn't even come out yet. And I feel I've got a professional bump from it. My mailing list has gone up, which is something I watch very closely. And I'm starting to generate a little bit of traction with some of my other works. When I say traction, I mean I've got a little bit better Kickstarter following. I've got a little bit better engagement on some social media. These are small victories, right? But, you know, they're small steps, and it's helping me to get there. So I'm really grateful for the experience of being with the anthology.
Those are huge victories, in my opinion. I get one more person listening to the show, it's a huge victory.
Yeah, absolutely.
I feel you. I do.
And it was really two very different sides of like the anthology with Tara and Timothy, because Timothy's work I knew from the Hunchback of Quadrant, whatever the Quadrant 19. Is, I forget. Not Quadrant, yeah. 19. And like, I remember reading that book and being like, what? What? Like, this, it was so beautiful and so weird. And like, it was a thing that like at that moment. And then I read Water Wars after that, but I read The Hunchback first. So I was like already a fan. Okay. And then I read Water Wars, and like, it's so well written. And like, the art is so pretty. I was like, well, I want like I want to work with this person. So like, and then he pitched. So there's like two kinds of people who like are creators that I know of that when they pitch, like some of them pitch like very much like, this is my lane. And like, I'm doing another book in my lane. And often those are easier to accept, because you're like, then this is the thing with Timothy's work is like, it was in his lane. Like it's very much in the art style, in the tone, in the, like everything was like right there. And then there's people like me who tend to go like the opposite side of their lane. And like, I do this very violent book, and then I'll have like a slow meditation with Angela Odling about like what it means to like grow up and abandon the things that you love. And like those are two very different, wildly different things. And I think that because of my history, like I tend to get into anthologies even if they're like, but I really want like the one thing. And I'm like, no, I don't do that. Like that is for my long form work. Anthologies are for me to like try different things. And so Timothy, like when he pitched something, A, I already loved his work, and B, like it was in his lane. I was like, well, this is a, like, I didn't have the final say of this. I mean, I guess I have final say of the submissions, but because I tend to know all of the, most of the, way more of the people than Chris does, who's the co-editor. She does the submissions, like, and like makes her who comes in, who comes out play, and like who's on the fence. And like, then I come in and I'm like, no, I really like that person they're in, or like, okay, you made a good decision here. And I like look at the ones that I was like, are these people going to get in based upon Chris's aesthetic? Because aesthetically, it's great to work with Chris. She and me see comics kind of the same. But like, as far as connections, I want to make sure that like, I'm not giving preference to someone who like is not going to deliver if she doesn't think deliver is going to deliver. Meanwhile, Tara is someone I never like knew before ever. Except that she submitted and then relentlessly like messaged me with questions after the submission process or during the submission process, which I normally do not like. But like that is because they generally bug me about like, when am I going to get approved? Or like, when is it like, it's something that's like, whereas her questions were like, after we started talking, were very much like, she was trying to get insight on the work overall, not like get an in to like getting into the submission. And I know that's like a very small like window, like, but like it is a big difference of like, I welcome people to ask me questions then when I am not clear or I do not understand, or like, how do I think she asked, like, how do I find, like, are the other books like on that? Can I go to and read the other books? And like, I told her where to get the other books, or like, it was like some stuff. So like, I knew from my experience with her that like she really cared about making a good piece that would fit into the anthology. Her goal was to get like you don't just send people like 100 text messages, like not, that's not the 100, but like you don't come back to people asking follow up questions like if you don't really care. So when it came down to like these, no, the there's always the ones that are like in, like these are in for sure, these are out for sure, and then there's all of this big mass that are like, most of them are like, man, well, like, I wish they didn't do 8 pages, or like, man, we already accepted this one and this is really thematically similar, or like, man, 8 of these stories are Dagon and like, I'm only going to pick one Dagon deep one story, like I can't have like 10 of these. So like some of them, you're like, you put in buckets. You're like, here's all the Dagon, we have too many funny ones. We need sad ones. And we happen to have like, so we have these spaces. And we have people that, like, we go back to, like we did with Tara, and say, like, well, like, your pitch is too long. We don't know who you are. So, like, we're definitely not going to give you the max amount of pages, even if we knew. Even if we had the space. Like, we don't know you, and so we're not going to trust you to deliver a big story. And I think that's something that I always tell creators. If you're pitching someone new and you are new, like, 8-page stories are for me reserved for people that I know are going to deliver, because that is a lot of pages. And I've done anthologies where like brand new artists do 16 pages and I'm like, oh my God, these are 16 pages and they're just okay. So like, I can't do that ever again. Sometimes people knock it out of the park, but usually they don't. So I went back and I said, hey, can you do that? I don't know. It was like 2 or 4 pages, whatever it was. And then like, it happened that we went some other way after she pitched. And then that person ended up, and then some shenanigans ended up happening and we had like more space. Someone ended up dropping out of the book who had an 8-page story. And that allowed us.
You can still give a proposal. It's fine.
Yeah. No, it was definitely not him. he delivered an amazing story, like a like perfection story that ends the book. But it was
I love you, David.
Someone had to drop out of the book for reasons, and we had a chance, and we specifically wanted to, because of the way that it all happened. We very much wanted to highlight more women creators, and we happened to have like a bunch of like a set of like amazing like women marginalized group creators, and we were like, well, let's go back to them and like see if they can like we have space now. Like, this was not the book was bad. The story was bad. This was like a good story that we really wanted to find a way to get into, but like we just could not do it. So we ended up going back to Tara and another creator, or maybe two other creators, to like fill that space. And like so that's two very different ways that you can get into an anthology. And I'm so happy that we were able to. I'm not happy with the situation that caused the creator to like drop out, but I am very, very happy that we were able to bring in Tara in, and that she was game. Because sometimes you're not sometimes the thing that people do is they will not get a submission, and then they will like, they won't say the name of the anthology that like they badmouth, but like they'll just start saying, I got a rejection, and like, then trash talk the editor. And I'm like, I'm on social media. Like, I followed you because you submitted to the anthology. And like, I literally know submissions just went out. Like, rejections just went out. And then 15 minutes later on social media complaining about it. And I'm like, now I really don't want to work with you. And like, there was none of that with Tara and
on social media blaming myself. I was like, I put in something too long. I shouldn't have done it.
That is the absolute number one worst thing you can do as an, and I mean, besides bad mouthing when you get rejected, but like, almost always anthologies are looking to fill like small spots, like 2-page spots. At least for me, I'm very wary to take anyone over 2 pages that I don't know will deliver and has a history. I'm worried about taking people who do have a history of like delivering and like for more than 2 pages that I've not worked with before. But like, I'm very wary of somebody, not just because they could be terrible human. They could be a terrible human like that I don't want to work with, and I regret having in the anthology. I don't want to spotlight them, but also they could make a story that is lukewarm and not great, or good and not great. And like, if you do that, and if you deliver or they could not deliver a story at all. Like, if you deliver a story and it's like pretty good but not great, like having it as 2 or 4 pages is like perfectly acceptable, because you just people like, oh, this is, oh, it's done, cool, awesome.
Yeah, especially Tara here, those 4-page stories, everything are so, so important. I always tell this story because it's someone I met before she was a big deal, and now she's a big deal and everybody loves her. But everybody here knows who Stephanie Phillips is, right? DC Comics.
I love Stephanie. Yeah.
And when I met her, she was at a Comic-Con and she just got done doing her first Kickstarter. And she eventually got to one of their anthology books, and she did a 4-page story about Wildcat. Now, other than me and my buddy Mike, I don't think anybody on the planet cares about Wildcat. But she knocked it out of the park, and now 2 years later, she's doing Harley Quinn all the time. So
nice.
Those little 4-page stories are the ones that people look at and go, okay, they can tell a story in 4 pages. They could definitely do it in 20 or 22 or however many pages we're doing comics these days. Yeah. So, you got into a little bit of my follow-up question, Russ, which was, what do you look for when people like Timothy and Tara are giving you submissions? Like, are they sending you full stories, or are you doing pitches with some character work? Like, what is your submission process like?
Yeah, I don't think it's fair to ask for full scripts or anything until someone's approved, because that's like a lot of work to do. And so I do a pitch. They have to do the pitch, which is like a paragraph or like a log line. Doesn't really matter. In fact, like a log line to me works just as well as like a full pitch for a story, because like I want the vibe. And then the art is essentially important. And I need someone who has done sequential work. And by sequential work, I don't mean 5 like pages of five different stories where they have done a page. I mean, like someone who has three to five page samples of three different books that they have done sequentially, like page one, then page two, then page three. I say sequential work, and then I get all of the time, like someone who like gives me page 20 of this story and page 12 of this story and page three of this story. And I'm like, that doesn't show me how you can model. And what I'm looking for is, can you stay consistent? Can you stay on model? And can you make boring talking head scenes exciting? And really, I mean, that's to me, like, not anyone, but like, it's much easier to make a really exciting page exciting than like a talking head. So I want to see how you deal with an entire scene, at least, or a couple of scenes. But I don't ask you to have the pitch, the story done. That's great when you do, when you have concept art or anything like that. But like, the thing that people get wrong all of the time is they'll send me concept art and I'll be like, cool, what art? Can you do art? Like, can you do comics? I don't understand. And what I'm really looking for is the hook. Like, because these stories are small, it's not fair. I'll tell this story about Travis Gibb. Like, Travis Gibb, who I love and was in our last anthology, originally did not make the cut to our last anthology because I thought his Cats of Ulthar story was something we'd done already. Like, I didn't get it. It was very much a simple, like, the pitch was very much like, it's Cats of Ulthar in a trailer park. And I was like, okay, well, man, we had Megan Hutchinson do the Cats of Ulthar book. Like Megan Hutchinson is like a superstar. Like, I don't want to, like, you can't do another Cats of Ulthar. And so I rejected him because of Cats of Ulthar, that because of that. And then he went and did the story. And I was like, this is great. Like, it was very much just like a kind of a twist, like a modern twist on the Cats of Ulthar. But the way that he put it together was, the execution was great. And so I was like, yeah, can I have that, please? I know I said I didn't want it, but like, I really do want it now, please. And that was because the pitch didn't, like, the hook wasn't strong. So a lot of times you will have a pitch and the execution can be great, but in the hook, I really need that one, what's the turn going to be that's going to like make this different? Like Timothy's story has an incredible turn. And you're like, oh. And then when you have a small story, you really need the turn because that's what's going to get people to remember the story. And so that's really what I'm looking for. You can have a little bit not as good turn or not good turn at all if your art is like amazing or like if I've worked with you a bunch before or something. Like, there are all these rules where like I will just like auto, if Angela Odling ever submits, like, she's in to literally anything I ever do for the rest of my career. She doesn't even need to put a pitch in. She just has to tell me how long it's going to be, and like, she's in. Because we've worked together for so long, like we've done books together. She's worked on me the art, so she doesn't need to like pitch me. I'm just gonna accept her, like, sight unseen, basically. She's knocked it out of the park every time we've worked together. So like, there are certain people that you just know they're gonna deliver. Like Travis, I'd never worked with before. I didn't ever even work with him on Cthulhu Invades Oz before because he submitted that after. So I didn't know. I knew his work, but I didn't know like how much editorial I would need to do. Cause some people get there with a strong editor. Some people get there after like a long time and it's a long process. And some people, you read the end product and you're like, oh, like you're just that good a creator. You're in touch with your own soul of like what you need to do. So like, that's kind of what I look for, is a really good hook incredible art. I don't have like a style that I really love the art, but like, if you have a much more avant-garde style, you're much better off having a shorter book, having a shorter story, because it's a lot harder for me to give 8 pages to an avant-garde art style because this is a mass market book.
So all I heard from that whole thing was that you skipped over Travis this time to get the real talent, which was his wife, because you knew you didn't get that to her. So we're getting close to time. I guess this is just part one, everybody. We're going to have a part two. If you're listening to this, it's like 2 seconds after. So I guess before we jump out, let's start with Tara. Where can people find you online, follow you as you go beyond this series and do your own things?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram at taraclarkson.comics and Twitter at taraclarkson82. And those are the easiest places to find me because I have my link tree up. So that's got the books that I'm in, the things that I do.
And Timothy, remind everybody where to find you.
The big one for me right now is I'm on Kickstarter under the Water Wars. If you look for that, you will probably find me. Also, I'm on Facebook all the time these days. That's Timothy Fling. That's where I seem to be getting the most followers. I do have a website. That's earthdogstudios.com.
And Russ, I'll let you do this twice in this episode. So tell everybody where to go to find you.
The easiest way to find me is russellnolte.com, but you can find the book at cthulhuishardtospell.com. That's Cthulhu, C-T-H-U-L-H-U. Second H is for horror.
All right, everybody. So go find, you can find the link for the Kickstarter down below in the show notes. I'm going to do this speech twice. Get over it. And make sure to follow everybody here. See their awesome work moving forward. And in the next segment, not only we talk to more creators about their stories, but we'll also get more into the nitty gritty of the Kickstarter in that one. So thank you all so much. And I'll be back in like 5 minutes. All right, everybody. After that little interlude, now we're back with part two of the Cthulhu's Hard to Spell, Volume 3 Anthology. Interview, and we have with us once again Russell Nolte and JD Oliva and Jessica Mason. Welcome, all three of you.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I was told that Russ had to be here the whole time. It's a whole thing, but anyways. So in the first half, we talked about some of the stories. We got into kind of nitty gritty of some of the behind the scenes of the book itself. And in this part, for everyone out there, we're going to talk a little more about the Kickstarter, but we also have two new guests, so I want to get into their stories before we get too deep. So I guess let's start with JD. Can you give the pitch for your story in this anthology?
My story is it's kind of like a boogeyman story. It's I have this character from these prose books that I write. He's like basically like the Equalizer meets the X-Files, right? And I wanted to do something different with him than just write the prose books I've been writing. So my story is about this this assassin character is in a diner and he meets a kid who shouldn't be there. And the kid says, I can't go back home because the boogeyman is there. So he takes him home and finds out that that is in fact accurate. The boogeyman is there. And it's these monsters in the closet. And just when he's about to unleash on them, he finds out the kid is actually one of them and he falls through into a portal. And that's the whole story, but it's a lot. It was so much fun to write this. So that was my story for the book.
So you weren't here for the first part where I explained my ignorance of Lovecraftian horror. Is the boogeyman a Lovecraft thing?
No, it's not. It's actually not a Lovecraft character specifically, but I kind of reworked it because I've had this story kicking around in my head for years, but I just couldn't think of a way to make it work, right? And it's just kind of just one of those things you file away in the back of your head. And then I saw Russell had this open pitch for this thing, and the idea really came to me. I'm like, oh my gosh, this would work perfectly in Lovecraft, because I want to take my books. The next book in my series is actually going to go into a Lovecraft direction. So I kind of use this to springboard my brain into that realm more than anything. There's nothing like continuity wise to it, but it really kind of got me reading more Lovecraft because, you know, I've backed all these Kickstarters before, but I'm not really a huge Lovecraft fan. And I actually really got into it more getting ready to write this story than I'd ever had before. And I really fell in love is a harsh term, but I mean, like, I really got super into the idea of cosmic horror and what that's about. So this really kind of got me more interested in Lovecraft than I ever have before. And it was a lot of fun to do. And it's a fun world to play in. I'm looking forward to doing it more often on my own.
So Russell, you weren't lying to me. People who aren't that into Lovecraftian stuff can still like your book.
It's true. It's very true. And the boogeyman is very Lovecraftian, if not like a Lovecraft character specifically.
Yeah, so excuse my Lovecraftian knowledge. I know Cartman rides him at the end of South Park, that episode, but that's where it ends for me, basically. Jessica, your story. Can I get the pitch for that one?
Yeah, my story is Forever Home, and I kind of blended two. I wanted to bring Mary Shelley kind of into the Lovecraft world, and like JD, I am going in a direction with these characters that are in my story. And basically, you join in the anthology. You join the characters, and they're coming upon like a cult of Hastur, and they're doing a monster fight club basically, and they're abusing these monsters and making them fight each other to the death. And a supernatural version of Mary Shelley and her sidekick Frank show up and put an end to all of that and kind of show them how real old, you know, evil spirits use the Necronomicon to open a hellmouth. So it's you know, a lot of fun. And I really wanted to bring another, like, Mary Shelley, like this awesome a sci-fi writer into this world and kind of face off with Lovecraft kind of a metaphorically way. So I was glad that Russell accepted it.
Well, yeah. Jessica is like the OG fan of like the anthology series. Like, I met her at a convention after, like, I think after getting the monster books, her and her two like amazing like kids were at my table. And I was like, oh, this is like exactly who I'm making this book for. Like, this mother and like her two like kids who like this kind of like creepy, weird stuff that's like both like cute and scary at the same time. And it really, I mean, she, like, her liking the book and the family, like, really, like, that's who I wrote this, I do this whole series for.
So my kids are like the target audience. Yeah. And they do love that kind of, and you know, I have to say, I was always liked Lovecraft and cosmic, you know, horror growing up. But I never thought of it for kids. And I remember before I met Russell, my friend gave me this book called Where Is My Shoggoth? And it's just this cute little terrifying story about this kid who goes through and he's looking for a shoggoth, and he seems, it kind of made me think of your story a little bit, JD, because you had a kid in it in the beginning, and he seems like he needs help, but it's not quite, I mean, he kind of needs help, but he's luring him in as well. Yeah. And then I met Russell, and yeah, I do have all the anthologies for sure. And I was in the last anthology as well. So it was fun. They're fun.
So this should be kind of interesting too, because my next question was, how was the submission process for you? What did you guys do for it? So I'm assuming, Jessica, you're going to have a much different story than JD. So maybe we'll do it the opposite. We'll start with Jessica this time.
Well, you know, I saw that he did the open pitch, and I loved being in the second one. The second one, I did something a little more serious about border control and, you know, I can't, the goat of my brain is, I'm sorry, guys, I'm going to apologize. Sunday's been a long one for me. I saw the Battle Royale concept, and I just loved that. And I love the idea of them all, different battles and a whole book full of different battles. And I'm like, you know what? I want to do this project with this new artist. I want to draw these I want her to draw these characters. I want us to work together. I love doing Russell's book. And so I wrote a story that would fit that book, and she said yes, and he said yes, and it was awesome. So yeah, but yeah, it was a good process.
So I guess go ahead.
And Chris and Russell are great. They're very open and honest and straightforward. So that makes it real easy. As a creator, personally, I don't like when people tell you they like something or don't like it and you can't get a straight answer, and they're great to work with.
Yeah. So I guess before I jump to JD, Russell, on your end for that the second time around, were you like, did you still need as much of a pitch from her, or were you like, I worked with Jessica, I know she can handle this, she's on top of the list?
I'll be honest, I was surprised to see it such a fun, playful story, because Jessica, I know all of Pestle and all just stuff Jessica's done, and like, I wouldn't call it like light and breezy reads. They're very like hard to emotionally control, like get into, because it deals with a lot of heavy subjects. So like, when she said she wanted to do something more like this, I was like, I mean, I loved the idea, and the artist is out of this world. Like, the artist she found is just an out of this world like find of an artist. That's like the artist you look for and you work with like once in your like career, an artist like that, like uniquely like that, like unique, that unique a style. Like there's a billion, like not billion, but like there's so many amazingly talented artists, but like I looked at her and I was like, this is like not average. Like this is not like a something you can easily put into like one camp. But I really judge the success of the book. I mean, monetarily, you have to, because it costs money to make a book. But like on the creators who want to come back, like I can't accept every creator who comes back. But like I really look to be like, okay, we did a good job. Like we did our job. If like the creators felt safe enough to do it and come back again, and so having Jessica come back and the other creators that are in this book come back, like they make me feel like I'm like doing a good job making the product and making the kind of environment that they can be proud of, because like I know they're not coming for the money. Like they're just is not possible for them to be doing. They have to be doing it because they like the book. I'm hoping at least.
Yeah, it's not for the money. It's not for the money.
I would be interesting. We don't have to talk about that here, but that'd be an interesting conversation on the back end, how you handle that. But JD, how was the submission for you? Like, what did you go through, and how was it handled?
So I got I haven't done comics in a while. I've been really focusing on prose. But when this came up, first of all, the Battle Royale thing really got me, because man, I love pro wrestling. It's like it's definitely a guilty pleasure of mine. So I'm like, man, I got to go for this one. So
I've got a Sting mask behind you or anything.
That's exactly what that is behind me. I had long hair last October and I was Sting for Halloween. So that's, I just keep it up there. So this one, I felt like, oh, kismet, I got to do this. I've got an artist that I worked with on my last comics project a few years ago. I said, hey man, I got something. Do you want to jump in on this? And I sent him all of Russell's stuff. I said, this guy, he's the man when it comes to comics, Kickstarter stuff. Like, I want to be involved. Do you want to jump in on this with me? And he saw it. And he's like, absolutely. So we put our pitch together and I submitted it. And, you know, it was super easy to work with. Like, I agree with what Jessica said. Like, as editors, you know, when there's problems, like, hey, fix this. It's like, no problem, man. And I appreciate that. I don't like people beating around the bush and, you know, well, you know, maybe. No, just like, hey, this, do this, this, this. I'm like, cool. I love straightforward direction, and I appreciate that. And it makes the process so easy, and especially on their end when they're juggling so many projects and trying to keep everything in line. Like I don't envy them at all. Like this seems like a massive undertaking, but it's been fun to watch. I look at this as kind of going to like grad school almost for running a Kickstarter, because Russell has done such an excellent job. It's like, okay, I want to sit back and watch and learn, which has been for me the most important thing, is I want to get better at doing these things on my own. So why not watch someone who's done such a great job with it over the years and knows the material back, or knows the process, I should say, backwards and forwards. So that's the inspiration for me of why I wanted to be a part of it. And working with them, is I learned a lot on my own, you know, just take like watching the process go along. And it's been a blast to be a part of.
That's such a, something you said there just clicked with me, the back and forth between you and Russ, because that's such a hard place to be. I've been on Russ's side of that in professional life, where I'm very straightforward with people, and sometimes that comes off as you being an asshole. And it's really hard to like get that back and forth correctly. So it's really cool to see that he's done a good job with it.
I like I said, I prefer that. Like, I would rather have someone say yes, no, and then you can just go, right? Like,
yeah.
I hate when people kind of dangle things and like, you know, try to say something without really saying something, because they're afraid isn't the right word, but they're like, they don't want to like hurt feelings. And it's like, I'm a meathead. You can't hurt my feelings. So I just want to learn and get better. And I just want to, you know, make the project right. Cause this isn't about me. This is about serving the greater good of a project that has a brand name, to be honest. And that, you know, Russell staked his creative reputation on. So it's like, I'm playing in this sandbox. So I got to follow the rules. And that's been important to me, is like making sure you're, you know, I'm an athlete, you know, I'm a coach, you know, everyone plays a role on a team. So this was one of those times. Sometimes you're the captain and sometimes you're a water boy, and you got to know your role in every job. So this is, it's important to have a leader who's decisive and who isn't afraid to lead. because too many people are afraid to be leaders. And one thing I really respect about Russell is he isn't. He gets out there and he steers the ship. And this is why this stuff works, man. This is why you get these great anthologies and why he nails these major Kickstarters all the time. Like, it's awesome to watch.
Yeah. Don't tell me what I want to hear. Tell me what I need to hear.
Exactly.
Well, yeah. I do think that there is a way, Doug. I've gotten much better, I think, over the years, especially working with Chris about delivering news that needs to be changed better. Because I think that there's a way to couch a thing. There's a way to couch it badly, because I think the thing that most editors, or lots of editors, especially young editors, do is like they put off telling you bad news. And creators also put off telling you bad news about like they're going to be late or like there's a problem with their thing. But then oftentimes you'll have like the other side of this where people are like, fix this, don't fix this. Like, it's very dry and it's not like, we love your story. These are the changes that we have for it. So I think you do need, if you love the story, sometimes you don't love the story. And like, that's a whole nother conversation. But like, I don't know. I'm hoping JD doesn't mind me telling this story, but there was a problem with his story. Like, he shot a kid. He shot the kid in the thing. And I was like, you can't. So this is an all ages book, man. Like, you have to change this scene like drastically. Cause like, you can't shoot a kid with blood like in this book, even if it's a monster kid. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, it just was not going to be able to happen. And, you know, people can take that very poorly. And people have taken it very poorly in the past. And sometimes they just won't get the pages done. And, like, there won't be a story in the book. Or, like, sometimes, like, it will strain a friendship or something like that. But, like, JD – and I don't know if I'm getting better at this or like it's just like the people I've gotten better at bringing in people who won't get offended if you have to make a change. But the people in this book were very like open to doing all of the changes that needed to be done. And almost, and I would say 90 to 95% of the changes were like, this is a kid's book. You can't curse. This is a kid's book. You can't blood. It's a kid's book. You can't kill a kid. Like, this is a kid's book. Like, and I think my this is always the hardest book for me to edit because I generally do not do all ages content. And so people see I'm editing a book and they're like, they often forget that like you can't do that. We had Timothy's story last, like there's just that like a naked alien in it. And I was like, you can't have that. It's a kid's book. Like, it's an all ages book. I'm not saying it's not for like babies, but like it has to be appropriate to show to everyone. So like you can't do that. And there's always like 5 or 6 stories that you have to do that with either way. But like,
guilty.
But people are surprised that like I because of my reputation in comics, like I have to be even more careful on this particular book than I would. So like I am way stricter than probably a kid's book editor would be because like I like can't get away, like I'm, because my general proclivity and tendency is to not worry about those things.
Yep.
No, like I said, I appreciated it greatly that because you put it up like, yeah, that's a good point. Like I got that email and went, yeah, that makes sense. So it was an easy fix. I went to my artist like, okay, it's got to change a couple panels, shouldn't be a problem. You know, and again, it's like when you're playing in someone else's sandbox, you got to follow the rules. And that's part of the challenge. And that's part of what's fun is that, you know, when you're doing your own thing, you can do whatever you want. But when you, as soon as you start working with other people, it's like, okay, let's make this work. It's like, I have a 6-year-old, right? And I got to tell him, hey, you can't just get your way all the time. You know, you got to play with the other kids and you've got to, you know, make sure everybody's having a good time. And that sometimes that means, you know, swallowing some pride. And, you know, it wasn't, this wasn't even swallowing pride for me. This was just like, sure, no problem. Whatever you want, man. But like that's, I can see people not being as cooperative about things like that, you know. But I didn't want to be that guy.
Yeah, that sports team atmosphere that you have just brimming off of you, JD.
I try not to, and I can't help it. It's just the way I'm programmed. Like,
listen, I grew up playing football, grew up playing baseball. I get it. I'm just saying that it brims off of you because I've always said it's so important for a lot of people because it does give you the idea of like, you, once again, I can be very matter of fact. So sorry for this, but you're not important. The team is important.
Exactly.
So you just have to be a cog in that machine to make it go.
And I coach I'm a high school wrestling coach, so I practice what I preach. Like, work for the team. This was a team atmosphere, which is really fun, to be honest with you, being part of a team. This especially, you can see this anthology, there's so many big time players involved in this, right? And like, you know, maybe I'm the sixth man in the off the bench in this one, and that's perfectly fine. And I'm totally good playing that role. So this is what you do to get involved in these big major things. And I said I loved every minute of it. It was great. Yeah. And I appreciate it.
I knew I could sense wrestling. My brother was a wrestler. I was like, I know there's a wrestler on this podcast.
Yeah, that's me. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's similar thing. Like, this is really how you get in good with an editor, is like to do changes very quickly and efficiently. We had some lettering issues with Jessica's last story in the second thing. And like, you never know how it's going to go. Cause like, these were not like, you have to change one word here. These were like, you structurally have to like change the lettering to make it fit with this story. And like, you know, that can be an ego bursting moment when you send in a story and you're like, I just did everything right, it's gonna be perfect, like, yeah. And you're like, no, actually you have to go and re-letter this whole story and x, y, and z, and you only have like 2 weeks to do it in. And so how I really tell when someone is like, when I start to be like, okay, this person's like part of the team. Like they're like in the inner club, is like, if I have to give you a bad note and like, you go do that note, and then you come back and you're like, oh yeah, this is exactly what I wanted. Thank you for taking the correction that I needed in the spirit of how I meant the correction, and then killing it when the pages come back.
I think after doing that with you, and then I was in another anthology, I was attempting to be my own letterer because I thought I could learn it. I was like, I can be a letterer. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be the other thing I'm good at. And after the notes from Russell, I felt good. You know, I fixed it. I was like, look, I did it. I'm proud of myself. And then the next time I did an anthology, I tried it again. And I was like, this is it. I'm hiring. I'm done. Now I wanted to be a letterer. I was like, I can do it. I want to learn the craft. And then I realized I didn't want to be a letterer. I was wrong. So then now I hire someone to do it. Yeah. So
I'm sorry to laugh, but I went through the same thing where I'm like, I could do that. That's easy. It's just typing in words. Yeah. And then you do it and you look at it and you're like, that looks like shit. Those people are actually talented.
Yeah. Well, and I'm glad I learned all the rules and figured it all out on my own, because that helps me when I'm editing comics for myself and for my company. But yeah, it's time consuming, and to do it right is an art. And I don't know if I have that much of my life to learn that art, you know. So
letters are the unsung hero of the comics world. When they do a good job, nobody cares. When they do a bad job, we're all like, wow, that looks bad.
Yeah,
and this is not, so I'll tell my own bad lettering story. To we had to re-letter the entirety of my last book, like in the last month. Like, we had to bring in a brand new letterer, because I brought in a letterer and was like, here, look what we did with the lettering. And I was expecting like a little bit of changes, and he's like, this is a no, I need to just redo this whole thing. And I was like, so like, it's not just it's like everyone. I've been doing this for a long time, and like, I'm literally telling other people to like fix their editing, their lettering, and me, I'm like, yeah, no, this is fine. And it was not fine. So like, it is, there's nothing that ruins a book quicker than bad lettering. Like, you open it up. In fact, I see the lettering before I even see the art, because they're big white bubbles of thing. Like, it's the first thing that you see on a page. Like, just visually, your mind goes to, there's a bunch of blank space here, and then there's art behind it. And so it really like ruins the first impression of a book if it's not right. Like, I've often had conversations with other editors saying we should Travis hires Jerome to just like letter the whole book. But I keep coming back to like, there are letterers who have such, there are artists who have such a baked in style to their art that I would love that. It's hard for me to be like, yeah, go letter a story like Angela letters hers. It's like, it's so different and unique. And like, she breaks like every lettering rule that should work, but like it all, that shouldn't work, and it all works for her. So there are people like that that I make it hard. And it's very, to me, it's very hard as a creator to give colored pages and then wait for like a year to get the lettered pages back after the Kickstarter campaign. Like, I just want to have it. I want to have the whole thing done. So all of those things, I keep going back to like having each person letter their own. And then I feel kind of guilty about it. But then I see the pages come back and I'm like, no, this is the right, this was the right decision, because like I have a kind of stable of letterers that most of the creators use, and they like, and so it looks pretty consistent, but it, I think that it's hard to fit into some styles, like what is, would be considered like a traditional lettering template.
Yeah. So this is a little off kilter, but something you said just made me think of this. Do you ever have like, you say you have a stable of letters. Do you also have a stable of artists that sometimes you pair with people?
Sometimes I do. I usually do not, because I have a million art writers and like 10 artists who want to be paired with them. So it's very hard for me to be like, hey, artist, here's 10 people who want to work with you. Like here, but I do it sometimes. So Holly Interlandi did a story called Pikmin's Revenge. And I've wanted to work with Holly forever. Like she, there's a comic shop in Los Angeles. There used to be a comic shop in Los Angeles called Meltdown. And she was the manager of Meltdown. And so like, she was like a god to me as far as comics go. Like when I first was doing comics, like she was managing like one of the biggest comic stores in Los Angeles. And so like, she wanted to be in it, but she like couldn't find an artist. And so I knew Nick Torres wanted to be in the book, and I paired them together. But generally, I don't think, it's very hard for me to pick like a writer artist pairing that is good. And then to be like, hey, artist, here's 10 writers. You want to pick one? And be like, oh, cool. So now I'm going to do work on top of the work to find the right artist. But if I know for sure like that the style, and I saw her pitch and I was like, that's like, I know the style you want. And like, this is definitely like a Nick Torres style. Like it would work. Generally, I don't though.
Okay. So let's kind of transition over. The book is at Kickstarter right now, trying to get funded. You're pretty much, I think you're almost there, right?
You're about $4,000 away, which is still almost double what the average Kickstarter makes in a campaign. So yeah. Like, I'm like, yes, we're close for our campaign, but still, like, it feels like we're two regular campaigns away from funding, and we're hoping that we do that, you know, in the next couple weeks, and then we have some time to buffer on top of that.
Yeah, it's funny because everyone out there, I'm sure you've done a Kickstarter if you've listened to the show, but there's a little bar, and it's like it's so close, but then you look at it, it's like it's 4,000 away. That's a lot of money.
Yeah,
but it's so close. So, how has the Kickstarter gone so far? You're 2 weeks in, I believe, or 1 week in?
It's gone long. It's so long. Jessica can tell you the last one was 24 days. It would be ending next week on Thursday. And instead we have like a month left. It's very long. It's gone so long. It's so long. But I think it's going great. We had our best first week ever that we've done. So we did like 20 grand the first week, which is incredible. Then we had the worst second and third weeks we've ever had, which are kind of brought us back down to earth. We had a big troll who did a $10,000 pledge and then it dropped. And so our kick track looks really weird this week. We had a negative day yesterday. So like, this is the grind. We've kind of not had a grind. We've had been making like $400 or $500 a day, which is like pretty good for a campaign, any campaign. And we've kind of hit like this week has been, this is why I normally do a campaign of 24 days, because it's perfect. You're like hit this lull in a campaign and you're like, it's over. but what would have happened was between volume one and volume two, we lost $8,000. And I thought that if we lost any money, so we went from $39,000 to $31,000, and we needed $30,000 to just make the book. And I was like, if we're going to lose literally any money from that amount, I need to increase the length of the campaign to try and do more marketing across the campaign to like solve that equation of like, how do we get to the $30,000 if we have way less people than the previous time? Which we probably will. Like, you know, we're on pace to probably have about 650 to 700 backers, and we had 750 last time and 1,000 the first time. So this is the way that campaigns generally go. Generally, by the third book, you have far less backers, but because there's three books, people are pledging for roughly the same amount of money that you make each time. We've had it's been wonderful. Like, we have a theme song this time. I love our theme song. Like, the creators have been amazing. The fans have been amazing. It's so gratifying to fulfill the vision. Like, this was the vision was book one, preparing to invade. Book two, invade. Book three, the gods are working to push back. But I'd be lying if I said it wasn't brutal. I've done this 20 times before, and it is brutal every single time in new and interesting ways. This time, I thought we solved the beginning of the campaign problem, which we had last time, and like killed at the beginning of the campaign. And now we have a middle of the campaign problem, which is just, it's fun. It's a fun experience.
Are you telling me that doing a Kickstarter isn't easy? I mean,
well, people often think that like I snap a finger because I like literally wrote the book on Kickstarter for books. And like, I do a bunch of Kickstarters and like, I raise a lot of money. And they often do think that I just snap my finger. They'll also say, you raised $25,000. What are you complaining about? And like, both of them are valid critiques, I suppose. But like, I say all of those things so you know that like, even at the, I'm quoting for people that are listening, level that I'm playing at, which may be higher or lower than the level you play at, there's still a lot of issues. Like, even Brian Polito has a lot of issues during his campaign, even though he raises $300,000 each time, you know? And especially when you have, when you make projections that influence like what books you can do based upon how your Kickstarters have traditionally done. If you don't hit those numbers, suddenly you have to like put people out of work or like scramble some other ways. And so there's, It's always a fun challenge. I've never not had a fun challenge when I went to Kickstarter, no matter when I did it, for what reason.
The you raised X criticism, I always push back on, because I know so many creators, and maybe this is the case for you, you could say or not say whatever you want, but usually that minimum they're put up there, so in this case the 30,000, is to make sure everybody gets paid back, make the book, get it shipped out, do everything, and then you're lucky if there's anything left over.
Yeah, I'll tell people I make about, on a good campaign, I'll make $2,000, like, for all, no matter what it makes. Like, that's what was left over. The most I ever made was on the first Cthulhu campaign where I made $7,000 when it was all said and done. Like, that was the most I ever made, I've ever made, still to this day, on, like, one Kickstarter campaign. This book is going to cost $35,000 to put together because I kept the, on Jessica's wonderful advice, I kept the price at $40 instead of raising the price, even though the entire supply chain has been decimated. So it's going to cost, I put the minimum amount that I was willing to come out of pocket, the maximum amount I was willing to come out of pocket. But like, to get this book over the finish line with everything that we're doing, we did the song and the pins and the book itself, it's going to cost like $35,000. And yeah, like, it's literally to, that doesn't even go to overhead or warehousing. Like, that's just like, the book comes in, the book goes out, pricing a book has, you know, gone up. It's been like 5 or 6 rate increases on the USPS since the time of the first campaign. So like, it's just a lot. And I hired an editor, like I hired an editor from the first one. So like, it's just, there's a lot of costs, and I happily pay those costs to improve the price of the book. You talked about the back end. In every previous book that I've done in anthology wise, I paid a percentage of the gross that we made. This time I'm paying a page rate, which quadruples like the cost to me at the end of a campaign. I'm happy to pay that cost, but those are the reasons why you make those calculations based on previous campaigns. And if you're like, oh, this campaign just raised 10 grand less. Like, that is like, well, my costs were 10 grand more. I made seven. So with the second book, it was 8 grand less that we made. It cost me like 7 grand more to make that book. So like we were like in a, I was in a bit of a pickle at the end of the last one. It was the first week month of the pandemic, so I didn't mind that. Like, it was like the least of my worries how I would like continue like surviving as a creator in the middle of the pandemic. Each one has like its different. And if you have a $500 on the other side, if you have a $500 campaign, like, it's a whole different set of problems that you're dealing with, because like you have to do POD and you have to do all of these other things. And like, but I promise you, if you had a $2,500 campaign and the next campaign you came back on and it was $400, like it would cause a big problem for you. Like somehow you'd have to fill some amount of money that you were not expecting to fill. And I'm sure you would do it because like, you know, you guys, you're all wonderful, but like it would cause that problem. Now imagine you had a book that was 10 times more than that or 100 times more than that. And it had like 100 times bigger problem. Like it's one of those economies of scale where I've tried to keep my scale very, very low. So when something like the pandemic happens, I just turtle up and I'm like, I'm just going to make some books. I'm going to wait it out. And like, we're not going to like blow, I don't have a warehouse space or anything like that to like go on there. So yes, that's my long way of saying everything you said was 100% accurate.
I like when people tell me I'm accurate. That's nice. you mentioned something in there real quick. I want to get to JD and Jessica after this, but just something you mentioned there. How has the supply chain affected you? Is it just costs going up, or are you having trouble getting actual books into your hands?
I have not. Or is it something else I'm not thinking of? So I have not done the problem with me currently with this book and Ichabod is that they're hardcover books, and like I'm trying to bring all of my production back into the USA as much as I can, but like you can't print hardcover books in America and like survive. You just can't do it. Like the costs are just so high, you have to outsource it. And I've been told that not only is it going to cost more, but it's going to take three times longer to get here than it normally does. So like I usually would put like July or August and I put like December, and I'm like, are we going to get December? Like, is the book's even going to be here in December? So like, that is the biggest thing is not the money. The biggest thing is the supply chain. And so the time. And so I'm actually, on top of all the other costs I have, I am printing all of the Ichabod volume fours with this book. because then at least if they both get here in November, like I can fulfill both campaigns at the same time, and I don't have to wait till like the fall, like June of 2022 to fulfill it. Like if I'm hoping that will help like get people to still back four, even though there's almost no way that the Cthulhu book is going to be here by that time, because they'll both at that point be on a boat together.
And that's specifically a hardcover issue.
Yes. Yeah. Well, paperbacks are a little more expensive in America, or they're more expensive than in America than overseas, but like with the shipping and everything, like it pretty much washes out, and like you can take a little bit. I mean, most people that I know print their paperbacks in America. They print them in Texas or there's like three or four facilities, but like with and I print my paperbacks in America, but I do not print my hardcovers. The reason is because it costs like 68 cents in China to upcharge from paperback to hardcover, and it costs $5 in America to upcharge from paperback to hardcover. And that cost can double the cost of a book, or more than double the cost of a book sometimes.
So on Jessica and JD, on your end, I guess how much, other than doing stuff like this, or you know, maybe written interviews or something, how much of you've been involved in the Kickstarter, and what have you taken from this whole experience? Let's start with JD on this one.
This is the first interview that I've done for this on my own. I've just been sharing with my Twitter and my Facebook. I've been doing it with my email list, just kind of pushing as much as I can. I have a much smaller audience than than probably anybody involved. That's just fine. You know, I'm doing what I can. Otherwise, I'm just kind of, like I said, I'm watching and learning because I want to get better at this. And, you know, this was an opportunity to yammer. So I decided to come on and talk because that's easy. And I'm just learning and watching and trying to do the best I can to pick up a little bit of the slack.
So when you're watching, how much do you get interaction with Russell on this? Or are you just looking in the background going like, just observing from upper ground?
The last thing they need is me bothering them, asking questions when they're trying to run this thing. So I'm just sitting back, watching, reading, you know, when something comes up, I, you know, try to offer my good two cents, I suppose. And like, you know, just like I said, I'm trying not to get in the way and get run over, basically. That's my goal at this point. Just trying to help out and do what I can, pick up the slack when it's necessary.
How about you, Jessica?
Well, as far as both the Kickstarter campaigns for the Cthulhu books, I send out to my newsletter, which I have been building slowly over the last 5 years, and so I've sent out probably two emails that involve this, but I'd also sent one out beforehand to get people to follow it. I don't do as much posts on my social just because I don't have huge social media following. I'm working on it, but I do post on there and I talk about it. I mean, I'm also a science fiction writer. And so when I do events or talk to people, I bring up the comic work I do and mention the anthologies. As far as like, I've learned a lot about Kickstarter from Russell. I also just, you know, got his last book about Kickstarter. You would want to say the title, Russell, because I'm going to not do it right. How to
get your book selling on Kickstarter.
Yes. And I joined the Sprint group, which he changed the name of, but I learned a lot in that group just watching, and I did prepare my first campaign. I did not actually share it with the group because I decided not to do it yet. And that's not because I wasn't confident in what I had learned and how to do it. It was just that I wanted a slightly bigger audience before I did that. I was very concerned about launching on Kickstarter. I think I want to finish my trilogy first. So once I have the trilogy done, I'll do it. But I've learned a lot from just listening to or reading Russell's posts, and, you know, being in that group was actually very interesting. Just having the whole group dynamic, you learned a lot quickly. So, yeah.
So real quick for you, for anyone out there listening that's in the stage before where you are, which is, you know, kind of, I got this idea, I want to make it, but nobody's going to buy it. And they say to build a mailing list, but how do you even do that? What were you doing before you actually had a Kickstarter or something with your name on it to build your any of that stuff, whether it's mail list or just notoriety in general?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, sorry.
Yeah. Make sure. Well, I have to be honest. My first, I came from like film and screenwriting. And so I didn't do a ton of that. And so when I started in comics, I went to all these conventions. I talked to people. I had an idea that I wanted to do as a comic. It was really dark. It's about sex trafficking, and it's a supernatural superhero pistol. And she kind of gets her vengeance on all that. And that was before Me Too came out. And I just felt like people weren't talking about that enough. And then suddenly everyone was talking about it all the time when my comic came out. So that was a little weird.
That's how that works.
But I was glad. It was good. And then, Pistol was probably the darkest thing I ever wrote. And so what I realized is I was introducing myself to this whole new genre and world and medium as a very dark writer, which I'm not always that dark. I am. I mean, Plastic Girl series is also dark. I guess I'm a little dark. But so I just started. What I realized is I had to figure out how to get the email list going, you know, really. At first I didn't think so, but then, you know, just from talking to Russell and talking to a bunch of other people, you know, I started trying to do it at shows, and then everything shut down. I was just getting started going to shows. So it was like, I was still figuring out my style and what I was going to do at each booth. And then COVID happened, and my first show back is going to be LA Festival of the Books in April. I'm going to go with Russell and another author. And yeah, so I just started doing, I did a few viral builders, and I just then kept trying to get people to sign up, you know, on my website and everything. It's a grind. The email list is a grind. And just learning how to curate, like take people off of it and, you know, really work it right. And I feel like that's another job that I wish I had someone to do for me. But I hope that answered your question.
I feel like everything, and whether it's your side of this or my side of this, there's all these little things that are their own job. Yeah. That we're like, oh, that'll be easy. Because we have a mailing list too. And I'm like, okay, just put the mailing list. Listeners will come in. Start a Twitter account. The listeners will come in. And then you look at my Twitter and you're like, who's this dude? He's got nothing on Twitter. But So Russ, with the Kickstarter, you've got, I always go right down to the bottom to see what the cool stuff is. I see you've got some really nice pins. I love the championship belt pin that you're doing. What other kind of cool stuff are you doing?
Really wanted to do that championship belt as a belt buckle. I really, really wanted that to work out, but it just didn't work out. I mean, the coolest thing is the book, obviously. Don't do that much merch. Merch usually has a pretty low profit margin on it. But we are doing pins. Like, the pin is really the thing that we're doing, and the theme song. So we've never done a theme song before. I had Tim do it, and his partner Sterling do a theme song for, like, this. It's like Monster Mash meets Werewolf Bar Mitzvah, but with Cthulhu. And so I really love that. And I really love the pin that Aaron Alexievich put together. And like, those are the two big things. I mean, and then books, like, we have books, and then you can buy more books, and then even more books. And like, if you want some more books, you can get more books. That's kind of like the way all of our campaigns work. I mean, I kind of envy people who like do socks and shirts and sweatshirts and all of that stuff, cups and things. But like, we have some of that on our merch store on wannabepress.com, but the campaign's really like to make the book. And I want to make sure when I'm making the book, like, all of the money that we're making is going into that book. And that's really what's happening in this campaign. Like, it's the biggest one we've ever done, but like, all of the money up until like $35,000, like, is going into the book. And even then, after that, it's going to pay me for like making a book. Like, the little bit that is going to, like, I'll maybe be able to like go and like get some froyo or something afterwards. That'd be nice. Nice. To do. So yeah, we don't do all of that stuff. I just want to say that I don't expect anything from these creators as far as marketing goes. Like, everything they do is great, but I do put out a marketing plan for them if they want to use it before the campaign. And I think that more editors should do that, because all of the creators that I've ever talked to in this campaign were more than willing to do stuff. Like, we've talked to 100, like, we've worked with, you know, 200 or so creators over the campaign, and they were all game to like do a little bit of promotion. But like, you had to tell them, they're not going to go out. Some of them did, but very few of them went out and were like, hey, look what I did. I booked this interview. Don Nguyen was one of them who like was like, I booked these three interviews on my own. Like, do you want to be on them? And I was like, yeah, thank you. But like, usually, like, they will do more than I expect them to do, mm-hmm. by a wide margin. But you have to tell them, and you have to keep them updated, and you have to give them like direction, or they're just going to be like, share it on social media one time, and then that's what they do. So we try to send emails once a week with where we're standing, with what they can do. I do a post. We have a Facebook group. If you don't have it, if you're doing an anthology, probably the best thing you can do is have a Facebook group where you can share stuff and have everyone meet together. Because like, that's the point. The point is that these creators meet each other, they like each other, and then they like the book, and then they want to promote, and they want the book to be more successful. So like, for everyone, it's a better scenario if like you introduce the creators to each other and you let them like build a relationship that exists outside of your book, but is made stronger by your book. So I just want to make that thing out. So like, there was a couple tidbits of like, they do way more than I expect them to do, and I appreciate that. But I think part of that is because like, I do tell them exactly what the most effective thing they can do with their time is.
You got me deep with the Werewolf Bar Mitzvah reference. yeah, so as I'm going down it, it's pins and books. So if you've never read the Cthulhu, I keep getting you mixed up with Travis's book. It's hard to spell. You can get them all right here. But way at the bottom, I always get that one way at the bottom. There is one where if somebody wants to build a rabid fan base, they can get your crash course on Kickstarter.
So there's one that has, I think it's $500, which is all of the courses and the digital. So they get, I have a course called Build a Rabid Fan Base, which I think maybe Jessica took, or like a bunch of people have taken it, which is like basically how to find your perfect audience and make something that they're going to love, and then basically do it on repeat forever. Like build a promotion machine that works forever. And it's been very effective, I think. Like, lots of people have gone through it. You also get my, in that, you get my Kickstarter anthology course, which is literally how to make a comic, how to build a comic anthology and run a Kickstarter for it. So, like, my courses generally tend to be a bit broader than that. But, like, this is the literal thing that I'm doing. It's like, how do you build an anthology that will bring together a bunch of cool people and then make money on it and then use that to springboard your career forward to the next level, which is, again, the literal thing that I used my anthology for, Monsters and Other Scary Shit, and then Cthulhu is Hard to Spell. So, like, if you're like, I wonder how we did this, like, I literally do the step-by-step. You get that at the $400 or $500 level. And then my Crush It on Kickstarter course is my intro course, which is, like, basically everything you need to know to, like, build the campaign, but it's not specific to anthologies. And then, like, there's a $1,000 level, which is all of the things I just mentioned, every one of my books, plus, like, a grab bag, which is literally anything that I have in stock, I'm just going to send you. I don't know how much that is. I don't know what books I have in stock outside of the main ones, because they kind of come and go. But, like, whatever I have, I'm going to pack it all up, and I'm going to send that to you, too.
Awesome. So that's all there on the Kickstarter.
Yeah. And people have never taken me up on the $500 or $400 level. At the $500 level, no one's taking me up on it, which I think is a shame, because, like, people ask me about anthologies, about, like, building an audience all the time. And so it's like, I'm going to put together my literally best package ever, which is all of my courses, basically, for like $500. It's a lot of money, but, like, it is a lot of courses as well.
So, unfortunately, we're short on time. So, I want to get everybody out the time I promised. So, let's just end it this way, starting with JD. Where can people find you online? And where's the best place to send them for your other work outside of this?
Best place to find me online is probably on Twitter. It's my favorite form of social media, JD_Oliva, O-L-I-V-A. For my work, Amazon, best place to find me. I'm my novelist. I got a 7-book supernatural thriller series, Books of Jericho, on there. So features starring the character from my short story from this anthology. So yeah, Amazon and Twitter. It's JD Oliva, O-L-I-V-A.
And how about you, Jessica?
The best place to find me is wickedtreepress.com. I'm also on Instagram. That's dandelion451. And then my books are on my books are on Amazon and anywhere you could find them. Plastic Girl. It's the Plastic Girl series.
And Russell, remind everybody about where they can find you and this anthology.
Sure. Well, you can find me at russellnolte.com, the anthology at cthulhuishardtospell.com. And really, honestly, I just want to say the last one time. First of all, thank you so much for doing this. This is a long show, and I really appreciate it. But I do this anthology to introduce people to new creators. And so really, like, I wholeheartedly, like, endorse all of the creators, aside from Tara, who is a very new creator. I've read all of the work, all of these people's work who've been on here, and, like, they're great. I love what they do. So I hope you do go and check them out.
Yeah. And real quick, before I sign off, I always say this when DC and Marvel do it, and I mean it when Kickstarters do it and when whoever does it, but anthologies are great because they're, I hate to use the term no name, but no name creators who you aren't your favorite creator, but could be your favorite creator tomorrow on those books. So that's why I love anthologies. So everybody, yeah, go check the book out. All three of you, thank you so much for being on. I really appreciate it. And to everybody out there, remember all the links for the Kickstarter in the show notes. So click there, go pledge, check the book out, and let's help get this thing funded. Thank you all so much. I'll see you all here next week.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, yeah.